Good morning, everybody. Well, good evening, actually. So welcome to the third installment in Our Source of the Ages. We are now going to be looking into the Arabic Tafsir by Rabbi Saadia Gaon. So the first question we're going to be dealing with is... Okay, feel free to unmute yourselves if you have a comment, not to worry. Okay, so the first question we have to ask is, why did the Torah get translated into Arabic? Right? So then we went through why it got translated into Greek, why it got translated into Aramaic, but what was the need for an Arabic translation, right? Wasn't it good enough that we had Aramaic? What do we need another one for? This is an open question. Why do you think that there was a need for another Arabic translation, right? Why do we need another translation?
But people spoke it at a certain time, in a certain genre.
Very good. The Jews started speaking Arabic. So why would that have happened?
Why do we speak English?
Well, let me rephrase. They didn't move. The Jews were living in Babel and still are living in Babel, yet they, all of a sudden, they're switching languages. Why would that be? So the answer is, well, we're jumping ahead several hundred years. What? So the question is, the reality is most Jews spoke Arabic. And why did that happen? Well, a little bit of world history. So you may have heard of this little guy named Muhammad, right? So he came up, so he was born in the late 6th century, Common Era, and then the Muslim Arab conquests of the area near Babylon, and where the Jews lived, meaning also in Israel, started in the year 632 CE, led by the Rashidun Caliphate. For how exactly that is related to Muhammad and whatnot, please see Wikipedia. It's a very complicated mess over which caliphate is which and how they all relate to Muhammad and who killed who, when, where, why, and how. Interesting history. Terrible for those who were involved, who got caught up in the mess. So Babylon fell to the Rashiduns at the Battle of Babylon in 636, and there went the last of the Persian Empire. People speaking Persian, people speaking Aramaic, and instead people kind of shifted over towards Arabic because that's what the Muslim conquerors decided would be the lingua franca, and so it was. Right, so then some of the next issue would come up then is, okay, so I understand that now they're speaking Arabic, but like, why is it so essential that we need to have a Jewish translation? Like, what's the reason?
Maybe we wanted to prove that we weren't a threat.
So to prove that we weren't a threat wouldn't necessarily be the case. It's also relevant to note that at this time, there was a lot of religions vying for supremacy, right? The various people of the books, namely the Jews, Christians, as well as the early Muslims. So the Muslims actually at that point, at the very beginning in the 7th century, didn't even have a writing system. That slowly developed in the 8th century, right? But so slowly but surely, they all started trying to codify and say whose texts are right and whose God is right. And part of that is you have to start putting in proving it by showing people your texts and what you're saying. Arguing with a text that isn't there is very hard to have an original argument because they're saying, well, says who and how do we know you didn't just make up that proof because you thought it was convenient? So but there's also, in terms of from the there's another group as well, right? So that's the Christian, Muslims, and Jews are involved now. Also, shortly thereafter, there's another group that comes on known as the Karaites. Karaites, also known as the literalists of the Torah. Not to be confused with the Sadducees, who lived several hundred years prior, right? They're distinct groups. Also, not to be confused with the Samaritans, which is another group of literalists. But again, not quite the same. We could have a whole thing on all the various offshoots of Judaism over the millennia, and we'd be here forever. But suffice it to say, Karaites are literalists, and they got into a lot of fights with the Jews this time period. No. The Karaites are at their height at the time of Saadia Gaon.
Their height, they originated a lot earlier.
They originated a couple hundred, not that much earlier, a couple hundred years. They don't exist in the time of the Gemara. They only exist afterwards. Within 200, with less than 200 years before Saadia Gaon is when we first hear of Karaites.
You're saying
Because they were around. I mean, that's when we. They don't appear to have existed prior. That's a separate. Okay. When exactly the carrots formed, didn't properly research, but suffice it to say, they were very much gaining ground at this time period. There was a lot of debates between the Karaites and the let's call them the Gaonim, like and the Jews as we would consider to be standard Judaism at the time. There was a lot of debates, which we'll get to later in the presentation. Right. So the other issue is that when we have the Karaites, the Christians, and the Muslims, so they were each trying to put forth their own translations of the text into the lingua franca, which is now Arabic, to encourage people to join their personal prized religion. They want to make, so people were starting to say, like, or they were each starting to make their own translations. So maybe it's about time for there to be a Jewish one. So who's going to be the person to make the first proper Jewish translation? So the answer is there's a lot of random amalgam of them, which we're not going to consider to be of note, but we're going to jump to the one. So we're going to talk about the degree. We mentioned this from last week. We talked about Targum and how much people were not understanding Aramaic anymore, to the extent that they asked for another to switch the translation in shul. For the past several hundred years, they had been translating the Hebrew into Aramaic, which everybody understood, but now nobody understands Aramaic anymore. They're like, please translate it into the language we speak. And this is written in the, but this is a question posed to Rabbi Netzer Nigron, who was the head of Sura, the yeshiva that eventually Rabbi Sajigon is going to be in charge of in 858 CE. So, right, he does then. So they really were speaking Arabic and wanted the language to be changed. And he said, no, unless you want to translate it three times, which nobody really did, because that would be a lot. You hear first in Hebrew, then in Aramaic, and then into Arabic would be too much for most people. But that was what the compromise he offered back then, which we don't really think anybody properly took. So people clearly wanted a translation, and they wanted to use it liturgically, they wanted to use it seriously. But as I mentioned before, there's a lot of other issues going on at the time. So the person who's going to end up doing the translation is somebody by the name of Rabbi Sajigon. So this summary of his life is courtesy of Rabbi Mordechai Torchiner. If you were looking for more translated pieces of Torah, please check out the Torah in Translation on the second to last page of Toronto Torah. Well, you will see a lot of fun bios and translated Torah to this effect as well. So we're going to quickly go through his life, which is fascinating. But again, there are books written about him, and we only have around 45 minutes total. So we will unfortunately be unable to get to everything. So as far as, again, so this is a background we covered already earlier. That's the first paragraph there, talking about the issues of the different parties in the ninth century prior to his birth, in terms of the charism and Islam, straining things in addition to the already extant strain they had from courtesy of Christianity. So, and then here we have Said al-Fayumi, who will later be known as Rabbi Sajigon. He's called Said because that's his parents' name. And he lived in the city of Fayyum in Egypt. So he changed, when he was 20 years old, he decided to change his name to Sadia, because Astrolabe wrote his own dictionary from Arabic to Hebrew, from Hebrew and Arabic, right? So he's the first one called Agron. So also fascinating to look at that as well, but again, outside of the purview of what we're going to be covering. So his family was descended from the tribe of Yehuda and from the Tanna or Bechina of Edosa. And Rabbi Sajigon's lifelong mission was to end Jewish ignorance of Judaism and to lead with absolute integrity, which made him come into conflict with basically everybody else alive at the time. So as far as people he fought against, so one thing that's important that had him rise to fame, when he was 23, he started fighting with the Karaites and published polemics against them, and like meaning published works where he refuted what they'd had to say. Some of which he originally lived in Egypt, and then he moved to. They were in the whole throughout the region, as in Jews and Karaites lived kind of next to each other throughout the time period. Hope that's clear. Right, so they lived there throughout the whole time period, and then right, so he's running against them from Israel. So he does such a good job of doing so that they hear about him all the way. And also he puts down a calendar dispute that's happening in Israel at the same time while he happens to be there. So they're trying to change the number of years. Change when the date of Rosh Hashanah is going to be. And Rav Sadegan argues why we should follow what they do in Bavel. And he does, and as a result of that, he ends up becoming very famous and ends up and wins. And of course, what happens when you become famous after having defended a position of somebody important? Said person might want to hire you. So Rav Sadegan was invited to Babylon by the exarch at the time, the Reish Galuta, David Ben Zakkai. But unfortunately, they were both very strong personalities that had their own idea of how to run things. And then there was a certain monetary dispute that Rabbi Sajagon refused to sign off on, even though some of the other heads of Yeshivot at the time agreed. And then he kind of got half deposed, but he still kept teaching and writing throughout. And eventually they made amends several years later. Again, for more on that, again, look at a biography of Rav Sadegan, absolutely fascinating, or just Wikipedia if you want to do the quick version. But the full bio is way better. And then he continued to serve as a Gaon until he died at the age of 60 in 942. But he was a prolific writer throughout. Again, starting writing when he was around, he finished his first book when he was 20. Again, that's a whole dictionary when he's 20. Which is insane. So some of his works, the most famous ones, besides all the nice polemics he had against the Karaism and other groups. He also wrote the Emunut V'Dayot, right? Apologize for not remembering the exact Arabic name, but he also wrote a commentary to the Tanakh and a translation, which we will talk about today. He also wrote a lot of poetry, one of the first Siddurim, and much, much more. So now let's get into a little bit about the main focus of today, the translations that he worked on. So what does that mean? Okay. So the question is, why did Rabbi Sadegan write it, and how did this come about? So the version on the left is the highlights from the introduction chosen by Dr. Avigail Rock, who has a book on early Parshanim, early commentators of Torah. So in her book, which a lot of the stuff that you're going to be seeing is from. So she offers certain, like, what was his motivation? So she says that his motivation was relatively pure, based on simply somebody asked him and he decided to write it out. So that's the column on the left. I apologize for bringing it to you in English translation. Just, I don't speak Judeo Arabic, which means Arabic, but written with Hebrew characters. So I could show it to you. We could look at it and be equally confused together. But instead, if you want to view it online, you can. If you want to see the full original Judeo Arabic translation, you can see it on Sfaria and many other and elsewhere online. But for today, we're going to deal with just English translations due to my inferior Arabic skills. So he says, my only motivation for composing this work is the personal request of one of the students who asks for a book dedicated to the simple meaning of the Torah without integrating any element of linguistic flourishes, metaphors, synonymy, or antonymy. I will cite neither the questions of the heretics nor my answers to them. I will not explore the intellectual mitzvot, nor will I delve into the performance of the pragmatic mitzvot. Rather, I will translate the simple meaning of the verses of the Torah only. And I note that I have been asked to do has a purpose, and that the readers will understand and comprehend the issues of the Torah, the narrative, the command, and the reward, in sequence and with concision. It may be that a reader will afterwards seek to understand the fundamentals of the intellectual mitzvot and commission the pragmatic ones, as well as how to refute the claims of those who challenge the portions of the Torah, and let him satisfy all of these ends with my other book, meaning his long treatise on the Torah. Which we'll discuss. He had a short version and a long version. So the brief one may inspire him to this end and lead him to his object. Bearing all this in mind, I have written this book as a simple translation of the verses of the Torah only, exacting in its logic and following tradition. He says it's just meant to be a simple literal translation. But as we all know, every translation is far more than just that. Right? He says, just because one person asked me, and that's all it is. But also earlier, This is something pointed out by Dr. Richard Steiner, who wrote a book about the influence of Sajagon on the region and on in general his legacy in the world. So he says that, quote, a different passage forgive me for not knowing exactly where this was written, but again, from one of the other writings of Rabbi Sajagon, that said, for a long time in my hometown, I dwelled constantly on my desire, which was to have a translation of the Torah composed by me in use among the people of the true religion, a proper translation that would not be refuted by speculative knowledge or rebutted by tradition. But I refrained from taking that on because I thought that in the lands far from my hometown, there were translations that were clear and formulated precisely. So he said, why is this is him? This is a taken from an earlier writing of his found in the Karaganes, I believe, where he's stating this, you know, why he waited so long before he published his full translation. And he says, because, you know, he always thought that somebody else wrote a decent one, and it's a lot of effort to try and do an exact translation. So he's like, oh, I'm sure somebody wrote a good one.
Isn't it kind of funny that he says he'll think about it for years and years, and then he says, oh, Steve just asking
it. Correct. The question is, which is the real one? Good question. So, right, so which one was it? So odds are it's probably a combination of it, that he, you know, he'd written his own translation, probably for his own, this is a suggestion of Richard Steiner, Professor Richard Steiner, that he says that, well, initially he made it for himself, right? He made his own annotated, you know, version of, you know, of Tanakh while he was going through it, right? You know, the points he thought were interesting, right? Oh, this should be this, right? You know, the whole running commentary on the side of it. And then he was considering maybe he should publish it. There's like, I'm sure there's something good. And he's waiting till he actually got all the way to, you know, to all the way to Babel before he, you know, decided to bother with trying to publish it. By publish meaning he's commissioned somebody to manually rewrite it because that's how there was no printing press. So, right. So that was, and then he decided that it wasn't necessarily, and then he only decided it was worth it when he got a request from one of his students. So then it's entirely possible that he had it more or less ready. Just he finally sat down and finished it only when he got that, you know, that impetus of his students saying, by the way, it'd be really great if we had a usual translation, because not all of us, even though we are part of, remember, this is a student in the great yeshiva of Sura, which is one of the two main centers of Judaism in the time period. So there's a student, again, this is a student who managed to get into the biggest yeshiva, like makes, you know, think of Mir or any other yeshiva nearby, makes him look tiny, like relatively comparison. There's like only two yeshivas, like in Babel, like there was two. So one of the two, one of the students who got into there is asking for it. So clearly there's a large degree of need. If even the educated don't really know that much, they need a translation. So he's like, fine. And he publishes it. So, but now the main question is when you're making a translation, you have to make certain decisions that will affect very much what your translation will look like. So as clear from his introduction, there's two main parts that we're dealing with here. So one part we're dealing with is the fact that he's trying to make it as exact as possible. But on the other hand, he's not explicitly fighting against any of the heretics. But we'll see that he subtly fights against the heretics in some of his choice of language in terms of what he chooses to write or not write. Because we know when you translate, you can translate to avoid an issue as well. So here we go. So there's two different perishim. So as he mentioned before. Here are the two parts. The next couple of slides are very much courtesy of Dr. Abigail Rock, because most of the information is from her Hebrew and English article on Rabbi Sajagon. So one part is right the Perashat Katzar, also known as the short commentary, more commonly known as the Tafsir, which is the Arabic word for interpretation. So not to be confused with the Tafsir Marwi, which is the word for literal translation. Right? So Tafsir means it's the correct interpretation in simplest form. So as far as what that means, we will see that in a little bit, right? So it's not simply exactly literal, because if you translated the entirety of the Torah literally, it would make very little sense and it would be very cryptic. And it was designated for the wider community, Jews and non-Jews, to show them why our version of the Torah and our way of life is correct. And it was, but it did not go without heavy-handedly going into any theology. For that, you had to look at something called the Perashah Aruch, the long commentary. This is also written in Arabic, but it was meant for the more educated of readers who wanted to know more. It included analysis of different topics, the discipline of linguistics, halakha, and philosophy, but unfortunately, only parts of Bereishit and Shemot have survived, courtesy of some of them due to either quotations by other commentators of him, or by dint of finding some of them in the Karaite Geniza. Also some because, so some of the Karaites, remember I mentioned how he wrote this against the Karaites? So one of the Karaites in the 10th century after he passed away, so his commentary on Bereishit was actually just a blatant forgery copy of Rabbi Sadia Gaon's. So
how do we know the other three books survived?
They didn't survive. We only have...
Well, I'm saying, how do you know they existed?
Because it's referenced, we see passing references by other commentaries. Meaning, as if he says, I mean, we know that he said he wrote it on more things. Right. He said he wrote for everything that he translated it fully. He also had a companion work that was meant to be more in-depth. Just they didn't survive. For why? The answer is they didn't survive until the printing press got to Arabic lands, and then that's why they don't exist. So then again, because it's a very high level work, and not necessarily, if you don't people things are only copied, people found them interesting. So a lot of times works that may have been interesting, but we just don't have a copy of them because well, you know, insert name of war, pogrom, etc. Fire of the Library of Alexandria, diddle number, or fires in general, or overall turmoil in the region can very easily destroy fragile manuscripts, especially when they are the only one or two of it that exist. And there's another question that comes up as far as to whether it was written in, because it definitely was written in Arabic. The question is, was it written in Judeo-Arabic characters, which is meaning in Hebrew characters, or was it written in proper Arabic? So that's not entirely clear. So Richard Steiner is of the opinion who says that he commissioned both during his lifetime because Ibn Ezra mentions that both of them existed. We found some small excerpts in Arabic of it written. Also, we found some in Judeo-Arabic, so it's not entirely clear. But so the answer is it doesn't really make much of a difference. That's more of a question in terms of for development of language and the formalization of a lot of translational things. Such as, for instance, for Sadia Gaon standardized certain ways of transliterating between Arabic and Judeo-Arabic to Hebrew and Judeo-Arabic or Arabic, so you know which character would properly correspond. Because otherwise, you want people doing a slightly different one depending on the language, which wouldn't necessarily be the most precise or consistent, which would lead to mixing up of names and other things as well. But that's more of a study in linguistics. For more on that, please speak to the linguistic department at the U of T or elsewhere. Okay, so now some of the fun features of the Perush HaKatzar. So these are also going to be, some of these things are common with other translations we've seen already. First is the concept of avoiding anthropomorphization, meaning avoiding the physical appearance of God. This is also a phenomena that we saw in Unklos. Targum Unklos also avoids when it says instead of the God helped him, it says the Shekhinah helped, right? Or the word of God helped. It never says that God physically went with somebody, because that would be violating certain principles of faith of some people of the corporality of God. So he, of course, does it similarly, where he makes sure that whenever there is a case that may come up, that God changes it, right? So, for instance, so you see here the example of when it says whenever God goes up in, let's say in Bereishit Yud-Zayin, says instead of saying God went up, he translates it as the glory of God went up. Very similar to the methodology of locals. Okay, another one is in terms of he would often have a little emendation or an extra word to make it make sense when it sounds improper when it's translated. For instance, when Chava's name is Aim Kol Chai, and therefore she's called Chava. So the problem is like, well, she's not the mother of all living things, because she's not. She's only a human. So therefore, to make that sound more reasonable, he adds the word speaking things to avoid that issue. Right, so sometimes, again, it also occurs, you also see that, we saw that in some of the Targumim last week as well, where they add in a little bit of an extra word or here or there, so it'll flow a little better, and avoid some other problems people may think just by reading through. Another interesting thing that he did is he identified the original Hebrew words. He turned them to Arabic with local locales and names of species as that he recognized when he knew what they were. Right. So there's the whole interesting debates as far as was he correct in his identifications. But for more on that, please go look at any book trying to identify the flora, fauna, or animals or regions in Tanakh, and Reb Sajigal will be one of the opinions along with the rest of them. Where he, of course, everybody loves arguing with him, but he was first. So what can you do? Okay, he also did a lot of things to clarify things religiously to try and make it clear that it's referring to God and not potentially referring to perhaps a triplicate of the Christianity, or perhaps related sometimes to Muhammad or things like that. He made sure to translate it in a way that's unambiguous and that you would be unable to misread it as, oh, there are three gods. No, it's clearly there's only one, which is the case here. Melchizedek says Baruch Avram Lekel Elyon. He says Ha Kel Elyon, the high God, because that way you can't think that maybe there's others besides God. Okay.
I don't want to be on top of stuff, but I am just ignoring.
Yeah.
You don't have the Ibn Ezra has his 12 secrets and relates to different things about the Torah, which said the Canaanites from there and blah, blah, blah. My question is, if some people are so full of integrity, would he shy away from those things in his translation?
He didn't really shy away. That'd be more of the question in the Perish HaRuch. We'll see an example that Ibn Ezra quotes of Rasajigon. So Ibn Ezra definitely had Rasajigon and liked him. But there are times when he argued with it, as is often the case. So as far as Ibn Ezra goes, that's a little bit beyond. So he also did would change things as well. So he sometimes changes the sequence, such as what happened when God sends a plague onto Paro. So the problem is that seemingly he has no idea how could he be punished without knowledge of doing anything wrong. So Rasag says God informed Paro that he would end up bringing upon him and his house a great plague on Sarai's account. So it changes the sequence of things slightly. It's to say that the plague didn't occur yet, but it was about to occur. So again, but that is, again, a very substantive change in the verses, but he's able to get away with it because, well, nobody else can actually read Hebrew or Aramaic, and you just slip in the solution in to solve the question into the Arabic people speak. Well, people might not know what there was even a question to begin with.
I have a question.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in the Torah and Bereishit which does not paint Yishmael in the nicest light. And also, according to Muslims, it was Akidat Yishmael. So those could be problematic.
Correct. But generally, that's also because they have an entirely different storyline. So that's also their thing. For the longer refutations, I recommend you take a look at Rav Sajigon's Perish HaAruch, which we'll talk about in just a second. You can see his commentary on those sections, such as on the Akedah. You can find it online on Al HaTorah, if you'd like to take a look. I could not find an English translation as hard as I tried, but the Hebrew translations by Rav Kapach and by Professor Moshe Zucker are pretty good and should suffice to this end. So those are the five main features of the literal literal translation. So there also are certain features of the long translation. So here is from Rav Sajigon's own translation. Again, I apologize for the translation into English. I don't speak Arabic. So it is fitting for every thinking person to always take hold of the Torah according to the simple meaning of the words. And what is most common among those who speak his language and most useful. Unless sense or logic contradicts this expression, or if the simple meaning of the expression contradicts a different verse or contradicts the prophetic tradition. So right here he's saying how it's important to think about the Torah and what the translation and what doesn't quite fit. So if you wanted to put that into, Dr. Avigal Rock puts it into four very easy to follow categories, which if you've seen the Rambam, the Maimonides Rambam on his, on the way that he goes about his translation, in general. So he follows these rules as well. One is that the you shouldn't translate it literally if the sense of our sensory perception of the world of the refutes the pshat, right? So then if it says hand of God, and well, we know God has a physical form, you can't say that it's God's literal hand, or yeah, that just doesn't work. Another example is when your intellect refutes the pshat, right? So again, so first one is a bit more like eye for eye. We'll see in the next slide. Or the intellect would be, you know, again, theological issues by literal translation. The verses contradict each other, so that happens a lot. For more on that, please see the Gemara and most of the commentaries all over Torah. And also, when the sacred tradition refutes the pshat, meaning when the halakha clearly interprets it one way, even though the simple understanding would go a different direction, we should follow what the rabbis said. So for an example that comes into this vein. Hopefully this is larger for everybody to see. If not, let me know. So here, this is the question of an eye for an eye, right? So this is an example where you can't necessarily do the literal translation because it would lead to a whole bunch of problems for a whole bunch of reasons, theological, textual, etc. So now here's a debate where Sajagon is arguing with Benzuta, a prominent Karaite scholar, questioning of whether or not the verse really means that you have to lose your limb or your eye. So first we have Sadugan saying, we cannot explain the verse as it sounds. Hebrews on the right, again, also that's a translation via Rav Kappa on the left. Sorry, not Rav Kappa, but Ibn Ezra himself. And on the left, we have the translation to English courtesy of Dr. Abigail Rock in her article. So we cannot explain the verses as it sounds, because the man will strike the eye of his fellow, reducing the latter's vision by one third. How can it be that he will be struck to such a degree, no more, no less? Perhaps he'll be rendered totally blind, and the burn and the injury and the bruise are even more difficult to reproduce. And if they're in a critical place, the assailant may die, and this is ludicrous. Right? So see, Sadiyon is stating that you can't say to literally do the same thing because you can't actually replicate a wound. It is basically impossible, unless, you know, you haven't been a surgeon doing it, and then a surgeon does it again. It's like, well, that's not damage. That's just weird torture. Right, so Buddha said to him, but it is not written in another place in Vayikra. As you put a blemish in another, it'll be done unto him, right? So mum and mum this time. So then Rav Sajagon said, you know, sometimes the word in means upon. It does not mean that you will, you know, actually make sure he has the same identical blemish. Rather, it means you should punish him properly, punish upon him. Okay, so then Buddha says another verse, but it says, Kashir Asa Kenya Salo by Adam Zomim, just like he did you do to him. So then the Gon said, but didn't Shimshon say to the Philistines, as they have done to me, so I will do to them. Right? So this is part of his several revenge stories. But you notice that Shimshon did not take their wives and give them to others, which is what the Philistines had done to him. Rather, he simply went on a nice violent rampage and burned down their fields and other nice things like that. So he simply meant that he had dealt with them, deserved punishment, not in a exacting manner, but in a you got what you deserved manner.
Yeah, I don't know if I can say ludicrous, because the Hammurabi Code, it is not tied to the opposite eye for an eye. So legal text,
I mean,
legal text in that time did take an eye for an eye. So
ludicrous
maybe in
some people, but not. I mean, it's from a standpoint of, is that considered to be a fair punishment? The answer is that it's not a fair punishment.
But in those days, it was.
Again, it being something codified as law does not make it logical or fair. It just makes it codified as law and enforceable. Right? Laws can be enforceable even if they're nonsensical.
I'm just asking, maybe in this time period,
people may have considered it like that, but you could also have argued, even in the time of Hammurabi's Code, they also had a staggered one based on caste system, right? And based on wealth, which also isn't necessarily fair or make any sense. So then, yes. It may have made more sense in different time periods, but to say that that the Torah would have been advocating for that when there's a lot of other things involved and other verses, there's a lot more verses you could say back and forth to show what that would work better. But this is just an example of the conversation that was had between Rasadigo and the Karaite. Also interesting to note is that Rasadigo never quotes any in this argument. Notice he's always using a verse, because the Karaites only accept verses as argument. So therefore he is saying you are wrong within your own system of argument, which is quite fun. So then the Bejuda said, but if the silent is indigent, what shall his punishment be? Right? If he's all right, so then the Vilgo said, if a blind person puts out the eye of a seeing man, what should happen then? On the contrary, it is conceivable that the poor man may become wealthy one day and pay, but the blind man will never be able to pay. Right? So this means that if somebody is blind and they start going around blinding everybody else, they automatically get off scot-free, which is also absurd. Right, so this is an example of some of the debates that Rav Sadia Yehuda had, which probably took a lot of energy and time. Whether or not you found them fair or not is a good question, but definitely would have been a lot of energy to this effect. Okay? So, and here, and just for a fun tidbit, so here's a poem that he made against the Karaites. So the Hebrew original on the right, and then the translated English on the left. So actually, it might be translated also the Hebrew. We'll go with the English. So again, courtesy of Decker of Galarok, which fortunately enough has it rhymes, even if the meter is not quite as nice as it is in the Hebrew or the Arabic. So our God's law is swapped as they hop, to forbid the licit while prohibitions drop, without fear and without hesitation. How many cubits must my hut measure? How long and how wide for holiday pleasure? And what of its height to plan it straight? How many grapes for the poor must be saved? Is any of these with a chisel engraved? Or does scripture insinuate? As we affix our fringes to our four-cornered things, how many coils and how many things? Do you know if it is 10 or 8? All of these, and like them so many, I ask the verse readers, the Karaites, if they can find any, to lay out for us a fine explanation. But Mishnah and Talmud continue to reach us and derive all of these plainly to teach us, and so many, many more beyond enumeration. Right. So he goes. So you see throughout how, again, making fun of them for saying if you title as a Karaite and you actually try and put things to practice, it's not going to work because there's way too many things that are entirely ambiguous from the text that require interpretation. So if you lose all interpretation, you will have a nonsensical conclusion. So that is also a point that is different between you have the friendship between Karaites and let's say the Sadducees, is because for instance, the Sadducees had tefillin much like our own. They didn't try anything weird. So, again, they may have had a very weird tradition, but it definitely was not to the point where they were like, it has to be literal. To the full extent the carrots were going, but again, it was definitely a strange tradition. And for more on that, that's just, again for another time. So, and as far as if somebody would like to hear some more of Sadia Gaon, we'll have all the good translations in a little bit. First, let's talk about some of the impacts he had. So, the main impact was that how successful the Tafsir was is it literally became the translation in the Arabic lands for the next, forever, right? The default translation into Arabic, if you were using one of the Torah, was the Tafsir. In fact, if you go to an Arabic-speaking Christian churches in Islamic lands, they actually canonized as their version. It's like I mentioned last week, how the Syriac church took the Aramaic version. So the Coptic church took the Arabic translation of Sadia were available and canonized it, right? That's the translation we're going to use. That's what we're going to use in their synagogues, which is interesting. Especially when we note all the added edits that it had in terms of the translation to avoid it being Christianized. But Christians thought, hey, this is good enough, so we'll take it. Well, he tried. So, and also you'll note quoted extensively by many different commentators you may have heard of. This is Shmuel ben Chofnigon, Yona ibn Janah. I think that's a chet. Sorry for swallowing that. Right, Moshe ben Ezra, Avram ben Ezra, Maimonides, and Rabbi David Kimchi, also known as Radak. All these people extensively quote Rav Sadia Gaon, and what he did from his Tafsir, both his literal translations and also his longer one, which also helped establish a lot of things in the world of linguistics, etymology, and general biblical interpretation, credited to Rav Sadia Gaon, also starting off the craze of everybody trying to name all 613, also courtesy of Rav Sadia Gaon, but not from his Tafsir. So if you want to hear more about Rav Sadia Gaon, so If you want a general overview of a lot of different commentators, I recommend Dr. Abigail Rock, Zechariah LeBracha's book, Parshat HaMikra, which is available from Koren. Right, if you want to simply get the English version online, it is on BBN and Hebrew, in case you don't want to buy the book. But again, the book is obviously more edited with better pictures. So that is available for everybody. If you'd like, I will share the slideshow at the end in the chat if you want to download it, and also it'll be on YU Torah if you search afterwards. Okay, so another interesting thing to note is that I use as well is a book by Sidney Griffith. Thank you, Professor Barry Levy, for lending it to me. Right, so this is a general history of the Bible in Arabic and of all the permutations that went into the various translations, and of course the winner of all is Rasadigon. For more on the extent of particularly about the success of Rasadigon, there's that entire book I mentioned earlier, that the book of Richard Steiner, A Biblical Translation in the Making, where he goes through, where he offers his theories on how it was formed and why it was formed, which is itself fascinating. Again, if you want to order it, it's a little expensive on Amazon, but if you have access to the local U of T library, you can get it from there. Not a readily available book, because it's, again, this is the problem with a lot of the academic things. They're in, if you have a nice scholarly library, yes, but your average library would not carry this one. Okay, but as far as for all of us who actually want to properly go through the commentary, so we have a lot to thank to Rabbi Yosef Kapach for translating it. Rabbi Yosef Kapach was one of the rabbi of Yemen Jewry, right? Originally from Yemen, right? Also very fascinating life as well. The biographies of him that you're welcome to read. Also, just Wikipedia is also fascinating if you want a quick read. So he translated basically everything that was written originally in Arabic. He retranslated it into modern Hebrew, such as the Rambam's Perish Mishnayos, his Mor Nevuchim, all of Rasadigon's works that were extant at the time that he could find. Basically, anything that was written in Arabic, he translated into, because he was a great scholar who also knew Arabic fluently, and knew how to read Judeo-Arabic very well, and had very strong traditions on things. So he translated and wrote tons. Halakhically, most important for his psakim, his halakhic decisions for the Yemenite community, there's actually, so he has an entire commentary on the Rambam, which is monumental, and also is the source of a lot of halachot. He also has a book that's more popular one called Halichot Teman, where he talks about what it was like in Teman and what he thought and what Jewish life was like then. That is written in modern Hebrew. I cannot recall if there is a English translation of that or not. But also there's a critical edition of the Perish Aruch, courtesy of Moshe Zucker, which you can find that translation of the Perish Aruch, the long translation, we found on Ahal Torah. Online, and if you're looking for the Rasad, you go into Baruch Kapach. If anybody here has a Torah Chaim at home, so when you see the little thing where it says, Rasad, you go in there, the little piece there, so that is there's a longer version of Rav Kapach's standalone thing of Tassir, where he has more footnotes and explains more of what the literal translation meant. But here is if you can see, I don't know if you can all see my little thing holding, probably not, but basically, if you have the Torah Chaim, right, the nice blue one or white one. Right, it has it in there. That's courtesy. That's a digest put together by Rav Kapach to this end.
Is he considered the greatest of all?
He's considered one of the greatest. Yes, definitely most prolific writer who dealt with the widest range of issues. As far as who is the greatest, the greatest Gaon, that is a good question that I cannot answer. But definitely one of the more famous, well-known ones, who probably the most prolific as far as the extent of his writings that have been preserved. Okay, so, and just a reminder, next week we're going to be talking about German translations of Moshe Mendelssohn and Irma Shipton and Frau Hirsch. So if anybody has any questions, again, please feel free to ask. And hopefully you've learned a little bit about Rasadigon and the Jewry of the of Bavel, of the Arabic-speaking lands in the, before the about a millennia ago. And thank you very much for coming out.
I have a question. Do you think, I don't know if it's relevant to this series of courses, maybe talking about the reverse about great works that were written in other languages, and if there was any controversy of them translated into Hebrew, like Moreh Nevuchim. Like, I don't know, maybe it's not interesting. I'm just curious.
So, I mean, there was controversy that came up out of the translation of the Moreh Nevuchim, because, well, I mean, that was, happened even during the Rambam's lifetime.
But I know that, but I mean with the translation, it's not relevant. I mean,
translations cause problems, such as one of the main problems that people had was his categorization of Pshat. But Rambam actually, if you take a look, actually has very similar to what we saw by Rasadugon, has very particular what he means by Pshat, being literal versus figurative, and that he has rules. Just the problem is that he uses different nomenclature because he's used to the Arabic nomenclature. And when you translate that into Hebrew and the nomenclature turns into all four, those five forms turn into one word Pshat, well, then it kind of ruins it. And that leads to people thinking that you're a heretic. Even though I'm like, I never meant that because I said that you shouldn't do that. Does that make sense? You can still call him. There are other issues with the Rambam. But he says you shouldn't read it, so just don't read it. So listen to the Rambam. Don't read Moreh Nevuchim. Unless you're bothered by Aristotelian philosophy, in which case you should, but I don't know anybody who reads Aristotelian philosophy. So, but I know many who read the Moreh Nevuchim. Actually, that's not true. I know one guy who reads Aristotelian philosophy, but he's a philosophy professor, so that doesn't count. Okay, anybody have any other questions about Rasadugon or Arabic translations in general? I'll try and answer best I can. If I don't know, I will tell you, a professor, you should ask instead of me.
Well, Spain, they spoke Arabic then.
Yes, during the initial Muslim conquest, yes. When they stopped, probably when the Christians took over. I'm not entirely sure exactly. But at the time of the Rambam, for the most part, yes. Rambam was the 12th century. 12th to 13th. Told something, yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so, while I'm remembering, another fun example. Does anybody have anything else to ask? Another fun comment in terms of a translation thing done by Rav Sadugon is that whenever it says, Lo tibashel gedi b'chalev imo, he translates it as, don't eat milk and meat. Right, because he wanted people to make sure very clearly we don't eat milk and meat. So it wasn't necessarily literally clear from don't cook a kid in his mother's milk. So he just made it easy for us and translated it as don't eat meat and milk. There are many other examples like that. For more on that, that was just simply an easy thing that I found by going through Torah Chaim. And if you happen to have one, highly recommend it. But know that that we were looking at and there is just a highlight of certain words he changed. It's not actually his full long translation. For that, it's in a separate work. Again, it can be found on Allah Torah, and also can be found on Otzar Chachma as well. Okay, thank you everybody for coming, and yeah.